And so just to kind of catch everybody up where we're at, last week where we were, we covered, as I said, about four or five chapters, I think it was. And it was Joseph dealing with his brothers. And his brothers at one time hated him, rejected him, and sold him. And then last week they were coming and bowing down before him, not knowing it was him, begging for food, basically, because there was a famine in the land, and now Joseph is over all of Egypt. And so his brothers came, bowed down before him. He recognized them, but they did not know who he was. And so his dreams were fulfilled that he had had early in his life that his brothers hated him for. They said, "We'll never bow down to you." And then lo and behold, they bowed down to him. Didn't even realize it. And so whenever he had the opportunity, instead of revenge, he gave them mercy and grace, but it wasn't before proving them. And so we went through that process last week as he went through a sequence of events that proved that his brothers had changed, but it also prepared his brothers to be reunited with him. And so in last week's study, we saw, we could see how Jesus deals with us to bring us to himself and to reconcile us to himself. But even more so, we see God's future dealings with Israel in the end times. Both of these are going to carry onward in tonight's study as well. And we're going to see Jacob and his sons move into Egypt. And so I'm going to pick up actually and retrace some of the steps we did last week at the very end of chapter 45, because it goes along with 46. Sometimes these chapter breaks don't exactly fall in the best of places. And so in chapter 45 and verse 25, it says, "And they went up out of Egypt and came into the land of Canaan unto Jacob their father, and told him, saying, Joseph is yet alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart fainted, for he believed them not." Now remember, it's been 20 years since he's seen or heard anything of Joseph. And he believed in all of his heart that Joseph was dead. And so could you imagine how hard it would be for him to believe after 20 years, the brothers come up and say, "Guess what, Dad? Joseph's still alive." It says his heart fainted and he believed them not. "And they told him all the words of Joseph, which he had said unto them. And when he saw the wagons which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived." And so just as we're going to see all the way through scripture, this begins a pattern. Jacob is the one whose name is changed to Israel. He's the father of the Jewish people. And the Bible says the Jews seek a sign. It wasn't until he saw evidence, till he saw proof, till he saw the wagons that he believed. And so that's just a little bit of a side note there. But it says that the spirit of Jacob, their father, revived. And then in verse 28, we see something interesting happen. It says, "And Israel said." Up until this point in time, they continued referring to him as Jacob. That was his name before he met with the Lord and the Lord changed his name, right? One's more of a carnal name. The other is his spiritual name. And as we go through the scriptures, we kind of find it going back and forth. And it's interesting to me. I'm still working out all the significance of it. It seems almost like whenever he's being carnal, he's called by Jacob. And whenever he's doing something spiritual, he's called by Israel. And I've said this before, but I'm glad that God doesn't do that in our lives. I'm glad I don't have two different names. And one of them is whenever I'm acting spiritual, one of them is whenever I'm acting fleshly. But that's kind of what's going on here. And so his spirit revived in him. And Israel said, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is yet alive. I will go and see him before I die." And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto God, unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here am I." By the way, God's the one that changed his name to Israel. Now God's referring to him by Jacob. Like I said, I'm not completely worked out all the significance of this, but I think there is one. Things aren't in there just by a coincidence. But he says, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thy eyes. And Jacob rose up from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried Jacob their father, and their little ones and their wives in the wagons which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they took their cattle and their goods which they had gotten in the land of Canaan, and came into Egypt, Jacob and all his seed with him, his sons' sons with him, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his seed brought he with him into Egypt. And so that gets us well into the story here from there until nearly the end of the chapter. We go through the names of all of his children. And it says that at the end of this in verse 27, and the sons of Joseph, which were born in him to Egypt, were two souls. All the souls of the house of Jacob, which came into Egypt, were 70. Okay, so 70 of them come into Egypt. Now we know 400 years later, there's over a million of them. Depending on who you ask, what numbers you go by, there was well over a million people that come out 400 years later. So that's a big change that happened there. God used the time in Egypt to be kind of an incubator to bring his people out, to raise them into a great number, and through all that, kept them safe so they could grow to that great number while they were in Egypt. But anyway, whenever we get back to our passage here with Jacob getting ready to go down to Egypt, he's finally going to see his son after 20 years, and finds out, which would be an even bigger shock, that not only is his son alive, he's also the second most powerful man in the world at that time. Egypt would have been one of the biggest empires, would have been extremely strong, and he was second in command. So not only is his son that he thought was dead alive, but he's also in a very prominent position. At this time, the famine is still very severe. Remember, they had went down to Egypt to get food and bring back. That hadn't let up any. And it's going to continue for several more years. And this is one of the pieces of information that Jacob's sons brought back to him. He said, Joseph is yet alive. He is prepared for this time. He's presiding over Egypt. And he tells us that this is still going to go on for another 5 or 6 years, depending on the time frame. Still going to go on for another 5 or 6 years. There's no end to this famine in sight. And so Joseph has a place and a provision that he's now extended, an invitation to Jacob and his family to come and take part in. And really, that sounds a lot like what Jesus does for us. He's made a place and a provision for us. He's extended an invitation, and whosoever will may come. And so anyway, this invitation is extended to Jacob, to all of Jacob's family, even all of Jacob's children that had sold Joseph into slavery. Now there's grace for you, isn't it? All of his brothers that did him wrong are now invited to come, and he's going to take care of them. Personally, if I would have been Joseph, I think I would have told Jacob, you can come, you can bring some of your family along, but leave those guys up there. I don't want them. Put them somewhere else. I don't want them down here. I'm not going to take care of them. But, as I said last week, Joseph kind of put them through the ringer and found out that they had changed and that they had truly had a change of heart there. They had truly repented. And so in chapter 46 and verse number 1, it says, Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba. Now, Beersheba is an important place in Scripture. We find that this is where Abraham came to, and this is where Isaac had also come to, and they were both significant places. Abraham and Isaac had both offered up sacrifices here, and Isaac is the one that his servants found a well of springing water right after he had made the agreement with I believe it was Abimelech in Genesis 26, if I remember correctly. They made the agreement, and as soon as Abimelech had left, the servants come to him and said, we found this well of springing water, and they named it Beersheba from that day. And this was kind of a sign that God had made a place for them in the land. He had made room, because up until that time, Isaac had strove with all of the other men around them time after time after time after time. And now finally God had made a place for them there in Beersheba. And so as Israel, as Jacob, is leaving the promised land, this is where God had brought Abraham to and promised Abraham. This is the where God had brought Isaac to and promised Isaac. This is the one that was supposed to be for their inheritance for all future generations. And Israel is getting ready to leave it behind as he's going down to Egypt. Beersheba is in the southern part of Israel. It's over kind of in the border between the land of Abraham and the land of the Philistines. The Philistines are over toward the coast there. And so Beersheba is kind of on that border between the Canaanites, the Philistines, and the Egyptians. And so he's just getting ready. This is the last place he's getting ready to step foot out of Canaan. And at this time, he's afraid. He doesn't know what to think. He doesn't know what to do. And so with all of this, we can tell that he is afraid because in verse number 3, it says, "And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not." Just a good, simple rule of thumb here. If God says, don't be afraid, it's because the person he's speaking to was afraid. That's simple enough, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Say, well, how do you know that he was afraid? Because God said, don't be afraid. And so anyway, he's afraid at this time because he's getting ready to forsake the promised land. And he's thinking back to the stories that he's heard, because whenever his grandfather Abraham forsook the promised land, he went down to Egypt, and Pharaoh had actually seen Sarah and saw that she was fair to look upon and was getting ready to take her for his own. And he was warned of God, and the people of Pharaoh's place down there was warned of God that Sarah was a married woman, that she belonged to Abraham, and not to touch her. And actually, he became a curse upon the people of Egypt. Not only that, but while Abraham was down in Egypt, he also picked up Hagar. Remember Hagar? If he wouldn't have went down to Egypt, he wouldn't have had Hagar. And if he wouldn't have had Hagar, he wouldn't have had Ishmael. And if he wouldn't have had Ishmael, he wouldn't have had a lot of problems. And so Jacob would have been familiar with this. He's also familiar with the fact that his own father, Isaac, had started to go down to Egypt. And God warned him and said, don't go to Egypt. And he turned aside to Gerar, to the land of Abimelech, to the land of the Philistines there. And so time after time, they were told, don't go into Egypt. Don't go into Egypt. And now he's getting ready to do exactly what Abraham and Isaac weren't supposed to do. And he's afraid. But he's torn at the same time because his son that he hasn't seen in 20 years is in Egypt telling him to come. So you can imagine him being kind of torn between God and between his son. And he's afraid, what if I go down and this isn't God's will? Have you ever been at that place where you're wanting to do the will of God, but you're not sure what it is at that time? And you're afraid of stepping out of God's will? That's where Jacob was at this time. He says, I want to go down to Joseph. Everything seems to make sense because Joseph is in Egypt. He's got plenty of food to sustain us. There's a famine up here in the land. I haven't seen him for 20 years, and my grandkids are down there. And this is the answer to all of my problems. But time after time, God's told my ancestors, my father, my grandfather, don't go into Egypt. Is it okay for me to go to Egypt or is it not? And so he's troubled. And so he's already started on this journey, but apparently it has troubled his mind every step of the way. Do I or do I not? And so as he gets to Beersheba, he does what his father and his grandfather had done, and he offered up sacrifices there at Beersheba. And his heart's troubled within him, his spirit's revived. He's once again wanting to please God. It almost seems like that desire, that zeal's laid dormant in him for 20 years, ever since Joseph, to his mind, died. It's laid dormant in him, and he didn't know what to do, and now it's revived because Joseph's alive. But he's torn two different ways. And so as he lays down that night, the Lord gives him a vision and tells him, don't be afraid to go to Egypt. And the end of verse number 3, he says, for I will there make thee a great nation. He gives him a promise. Now, God's been promising Abraham and Isaac all along, I'm going to make of you a great nation. But he didn't give him a whole lot of details, right? And here we see the next step in God's plan revealed to Jacob. He's been told all along, I'm going to make you a great nation. They assumed it was going to happen in Canaan. But here God reveals to him, I'm going to make you a great nation in Egypt. He says in verse 4, I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes. There it gets into Jacob's heart. This is what Jacob was wanting. He says, I want to see my son again. And God says, it's perfectly fine with me for you to do what your heart is desiring you to do. It's perfectly fine for you to go down to Egypt. There I'm going to be with you. I'm going to go with you. And then whenever I'm ready, I'm going to bring you out of Egypt. I'll bring you out as a great nation. But in the meantime, you're going to be able to see your son that you've longed for 20 years. And so his plan is revealed to Joseph here. And so this turmoil that was within Jacob was solved in this, because he realized that his will and God's had intersected. It's often whenever we think about God's will, we always think that it's opposed to our own, don't we? We often hear it that we've got to give up our own will to do God's will. That's the case if our will is opposed to God's, right? But do you realize that a lot of times it's God's will for us? Now, don't get me wrong in saying this, okay? I'm trying to say this carefully. It's not what we often think, that we have to, that nothing that we want's God's will. Oftentimes, our heart's desire is God's will. Oftentimes. Not always. Now, if our heart's desire goes against God's will, then we pick God's will, right? But it's not like God's up there trying to figure out, okay, what does Peter want? Okay, that's completely out of my will, Peter. You can't have that. You got to do something differently. Right? In Psalm chapter 37, verse 4, it says, delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart. And so it's a great thing whenever our desires and God's desires line up with each other. And I don't think that God's just arbitrarily up there trying to rule out anything that we want or that we like. Some would have you to believe that. That's not the way that God works. But also don't go the Disneyland version and say that follow your heart and do whatever your heart tells you to do either. It's whenever it lines up with God. And so anyway, whenever our will and God's will doesn't match, choose God's will, because it's always going to be better for us in the end. And so now, as Jacob has assurance from God, he gladly journeys onward and gets down to Egypt, and he's able to see his son in Egypt for the first time, as I said, in 20 years. And then as we go through verses 8 through 27, the Bible kind of pauses here. This is kind of a parenthetical, they call it. And it gives an account of who went to Egypt with Jacob. And I mentioned earlier there were 70 souls that was going to become a multitude in just 400 years. I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through the list of names. I'm not going to read through all this because most of the names I can't even pronounce. I just want to bring out a few different things that we can find through this passage that I think are fairly interesting things. If you look at this, I'm not going to read it all. But if you look at it in verse 8, it says, and these are the names of the children of Israel, which came into Egypt, Jacob and his sons, Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and the sons of Reuben, Hanok and Phallu and Hezron and Carmi. And see, you already can tell I can't pronounce these names. But anyway, that's the best I can do. But with Reuben, he's the firstborn. Now, the firstborn is usually the one that's favored, the one that's going to be the leader of the family. He's going to be basically the priest of the family there. He's going at that time, because this was before the priesthood, he would be the priest of the family. He would be the leader of the family. He would get the favored position and the double portion of inheritance, all of these things. Didn't happen with Reuben. We found out several times that Reuben wasn't exactly noteworthy among the sons. He didn't really do anything noteworthy. He never really took a stand. He was somewhat wishy-washy in different times whenever the brothers were trying to sell Joseph. He tried to stand against it, but not too hard, and several other things that happened there. And so it passed over him without saying a whole lot. With Simeon in verse number 9, or verse number 10, and the sons of Simeon, Jemuel and Jamin and Ohad and Jachin and Zohar and Sheol, the son of the Canaanitish woman. And so with Simeon, remember he's the one that got left behind in Egypt. He's the one that got imprisoned by Joseph. And I said last week that I didn't know what was that caused Joseph to pick him or his brothers to pick him over the other brothers to leave behind in prison. But as the Bible's going through these different names, it picks out Simeon, and it mentions specifically that he has a son with a Canaanitish woman. Simeon's also the one, him and Levi were the two that went and killed all of the men of Shechem, and they took the women there, which were Canaanites, right? They took the women and the children, and they killed all the men. That may have been where he got his wife at, but I think it's also an indicator of Simeon's spiritual condition. God's the one that's inspired this, and he is leaving out a lot of the bad things about some of the other guys, but they see fit to put this little tidbit in here about Simeon. And it seems like it was a significant thing in Simeon's life that he had this relationship with a Canaanitish woman, as if maybe he was going away from God at that time as well. Not exactly sure on that, but it seems to be an indicator there. We skip over Levi, and then you come on down to Judah. And this is one of the last ones I'm going to look at here, because Judah starts becoming more or less the shining star of the bunch. And we're going to find later on, whenever it actually becomes a kingdom, after they come out of Egypt, after the times of Saul, after the times of David, and the land is split in half under Rehoboam, Solomon's unwise son, that there's two heads there that are mentioned. You have Judah, and what do they call the northern kingdom? Israel or Ephraim. It's known as Israel or Ephraim. And we're going to find that those are two of the prominent sons of Jacob here, even though Ephraim was a grandson. Later on, Jacob actually claims him as his own son. And these end up being two of the prominent ones. But anyway, with Judah, we find that he is now gaining a place of prominence. Later on, he's going to be the one from which Christ comes from, the line of the tribe of Judah. That promise is going to come to him and his family. But anyway, in Judah here, we see verse 12, the sons of Judah, Ur and Onan and Shelah and Pharez and Zerah. But Ur and Onan died in the land of Canaan, and the sons of Pharez were Hezron and Hamul, which those would have been grandsons of Jacob by that time. And so anyway, at this time, I pointed out with Simeon, he had a Canaanitish wife. That was brought out, wasn't it? But Judah's Canaanitish wife was kind of forgotten about. Although it mentions that his two sons were died in Canaan, it doesn't say it was because of their wickedness. It seems as if it kind of glosses over some of the imperfections in Judah and brings out some of the imperfections in Simeon. And I believe that's giving us an idea of the direction that they're going in. Okay. As we continue onward down here, I want to skip down to verse number 21. I told you I wasn't going to read all these verses, or all these names. You were starting to wonder, weren't you? But in verse 21, it says, and the sons of Benjamin were Bela and Becher and Ashbel, Gera and Naaman, Ehi and Rosh, Muppam, Huppam, and Ard. And these were his sons that went down with them into Egypt. The reason I bring this out is because last week we discussed a little bit how old was Benjamin whenever he went down into Egypt. And it mentions that he was a lad, but he was a lad that had 10 sons by the time he went down to Egypt. So you can kind of figure out the math on that. He couldn't have been too young, could he, to have 10 sons? He either had several sets of twins or triplets, multiple wives, something going on there to have that many children, because he still wouldn't have been an old man, but he was old enough to have several children. as a matter of fact, he was the most fruitful out of all of his, out of all of Jacob's sons here. Yeah, at least had a set of twins. Yeah. Why do people do that? But those three, Muppum, Huppum, and Ard.
Maybe they were triplets.
Maybe. I bet they dressed alike too.
Sounds like a good name for a donut factory.
Muppum and Huppum? I don't know about a donut factory. But yeah, at least a set of twins in there, right? I didn't quite catch that, so that was a good one there. And so anyway, he had 10 sons by the time he went down. As I said, he was the youngest and also the most fruitful of all of them. There was one son that actually only had one son, which was quite odd at that time, but Benjamin had 10. And so he couldn't have been too young at that time. He'd at least had to have been mid to late 20s, I would think, to have 10 kids by that age. And he would have had to get an early start at that. It just amazes me that Jacob was so old whenever he first got married, but all of his children married young and had children young. But anyway, going onward with this, I need to catch up my notes here. Verse number 28. We've gotten past, by verse 27, we've gotten past the list of all of the people. We found out that there was 70 of them altogether. And in verse 28, they are coming into the land of Egypt, and most of them hadn't been there before. The 10 brothers had been, but at this point in time, the rest of them hadn't been, Jacob hadn't been, and none of them had been to Goshen. And so they were sending Judah before all the rest of them to go to Joseph to be directed. Where do you want us to stay at? They're coming to a land they haven't seen, to stay in a place they've never been, amongst the people that they didn't know. All kinds of uncertainties, right? And so in verse 28 it says, "And he sent Judah before him unto Joseph to direct his face unto Goshen. And they came into the land of Goshen." This is where we see Judah, even though that he isn't the firstborn, he is the one that is being trusted. He is the one taking the leadership position. And not only this, he is the one that originally made the decision to sell Joseph into Egypt. And now he's the one going to Joseph and being directed where to go himself. And so it's amazing how that's came in full circle now. And so Judah is taking his place as leader within the family. In verse 29 and 30, "And Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to meet Israel, his father, to Goshen, and presented himself unto him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said unto Joseph, Now let me die, since I have seen thy face, because thou art yet alive." I know that's just kind of sad in that place. He's like, okay, I've seen your face, let me die. I don't know. It strikes me as kind of strange. You're like, I think I'd want to live for just a little while and enjoy that, get to know him, find out about where he's been, what he's been doing. He's just like, yeah, I've seen your face. Now I'm ready to die. Good enough. But could you imagine what a reunion this would have been? As I stated last week, Joseph was left for much of the time wondering why his dad never came looking for him. He never heard the story that his dad had heard. He didn't know why his dad had believed. He says, why didn't he ever come looking for me? Does he even care? And he found out last week that he did. And now all along that Joseph was dead. Finds out that he's alive. And so they come together. They have their reunion. And then in verse 31 through 34, it says, "And Joseph said unto his brethren and unto his father and unto his father's house, I will go up and show Pharaoh and say unto him, My brethren and my father's house, which were in the land of Canaan, are come unto me. And the men are shepherds, for their trade hath been to feed cattle, and they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. And it shall come to pass, when Pharaoh shall call you, and shall say, What is your occupation? That ye shall say, Thy servant's trade hath been about cattle, from our youth even until now, both we and also our fathers, that ye may dwell in the land of Goshen. And for every shepherd is an abomination unto the Egyptians." In this place, we see Joseph taking on his position as Christ, a type of Christ here. For 20 years, he has lived in Pharaoh's, in Egypt. For several years, he's lived in Pharaoh's house. He's learned the ways of Egypt. He knows what their customs and cultures are, and he knows what Pharaoh is like. As you read through this again and look at it, he says, this is what Pharaoh is going to do. He's telling them ahead of time, this is what Pharaoh is like. This is what he's going to do. Joseph's been around Pharaoh long enough to know what he's going to do. And so he's preparing them. He's warning them and showing them what they need to do whenever they come before Pharaoh. But not only that, he also knows how to relate to his brothers because he grew up with them as well. And he lived amongst them. And so he becomes the perfect mediator between the two. And that's where I'm saying that he is like Christ. Because Christ came down and he became a man so that he can be our mediator. But he's also God so that he can have access to God. And so this is what he's doing here. He is the mediator between the children of Israel and Pharaoh. And he is preparing them for when they meet Pharaoh. He's also going to go before the children of Israel and tell Pharaoh about them and argue on their behalf. And so that he is welcoming them into the land of Goshen. You see the way that goes? And that's what Christ has done for us as well. He can argue on our behalf and he can make us welcome in the land that we're going to. But he also can come to us and tell us about the Father. And so whenever he's talking to his brothers here, he tells them about Pharaoh, tells Pharaoh of his brothers. And we see in this that although they were going to be in Egypt, they were still to remain separate. This is an important thing. Remember, I've stressed this, that while they were in Canaan, they were intermarrying with the Canaanites. They were beginning to adopt the Canaanite religions and the Canaanite practices and the Canaanite sins, right? But God has called his people to be a separate and a peculiar people. He had a plan for the nation of Israel, not only to bring the Messiah into the world, but also to show God to the rest of the world, to be a light and a witness, right? And that doesn't work whenever they get tied up in the affairs of this world. And so God brings them out of Canaan down to Egypt. And in Egypt, it says that they are an abomination to the Egyptians because they are shepherds. The Egyptians were settled people. The Egyptians were farmers. They were ones that built huge houses, built huge pyramids, right? They were builders. They were permanent dwelling people. But Jacob and his sons were nomadic. They were pilgrims and strangers. You see how that carries over to us as Christians as well? The people of this world are building empires, and they are trying to leave a legacy, and they are trying to make something of themselves here. But we as Christians have an allegiance to a different king, to a different world. We are citizens of a far country. We are pilgrims and strangers here, and we are looking forward to getting to the place that God has prepared for us. The children of Israel all along were looking forward to the day they could get back to Canaan. And so with them being a nomadic people, with them being shepherds, they were an abomination to the Egyptians. And so whenever Joseph is coaching them and said, whenever you come before Pharaoh, tell him you are shepherds, tell him that you are nomads, that you are men of cattle, that you are pilgrims and strangers from the very beginning. Tell him that you know that you are an abomination to him and that you're not seeking to force yourself upon him, but that you want to go over here into the land of Goshen by yourself. And by the way, the land of Goshen was one of the places that was closest to Canaan. It was at the northern part of Egypt, and so it would have been easy for them to leave whenever they got done. And so with all of these things going on, from the very beginning, they present themselves to the Egyptians as being separate. They tell them where they stand from the very beginning. They don't try to intermingle with them. They don't try to mix with them. They don't try to hide who they are. They come and they say, we are shepherds. We are an abomination to you from the very beginning of that. And so with that, Joseph is bringing a way that they're not able to mix with them. They're going to be rejected by their religious system. They're going to be restricted from intermarrying with them. They're going to be considered to be unclean with them, and it's going to keep them apart. It's going to keep them separate. This is God's dealing with them. This is what God's plan is all along. Because after 400 years in Egypt, guess what? They are still a separate people. They are still able to make a clean break out of Egypt whenever they go back to Canaan. This is a huge lesson for us as Christians as well. Because right now, Egypt is a type of the world. Right now, we are living here in this present world, and we don't exactly fit in. We're pilgrims and we're strangers, as I've said before. Our allegiance isn't to Pharaoh. It isn't to the leaders here on this earth. Our allegiance is to Christ. We have different goals. We have different desires than the world around us, or we should. And the Lord has called us to be separate. He's called us to be different. The problem comes in whenever we as Christians too often try to, as I've heard it said many times, drive our tent pegs in too deep. We try to make our abode here. We try to set our affections here on this life, and we put all of our focus and attention on this world and on the things here rather than on Christ and what he has for us, rather than on eternity and what he has before us. And so we get our priorities out of line. We get our focus off of God. And more or less, we do what the Israelites were doing up in Canaan. We get so mixed in with those who are around us that we're not distinguishable from them. Now, this isn't saying that we are to treat the lost and the people that we are around here in this world as if we're supposed to treat them unclean, as if they're unclean, or be completely separated from them in that way. That's not what I'm saying, because there's a lot of people that isolate themselves from the world and they kind of live in their own little bubble. That's not what I'm saying. We're not here to live in the world or live in a bubble in this world. But we're to be here and influence the world rather than the world influencing us. And so anyway, a great lesson in there. And it just amazes me how God made provision for all this. The group that he brought them in, the culture, the society that they were in, did not allow them to fall into the trap they were falling in Canaan. And so as we get into chapter 47 there, just going to cover this quickly here. Joseph brings a portion of his brothers to come before Pharaoh. He's already coached him what to say. He's already said this is what Pharaoh is going to do. And so he picks out five of his brothers and brings them before Pharaoh to testify according to what Joseph told him to say. It says, then Joseph came and told Pharaoh and said, my father, my brother, and their flocks and their herds and all that they have are come out of the land of Canaan, and behold, they are in the land of Goshen. And he took some of his brethren, even five men, and presented them unto Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said unto his brethren, what is your occupation? Isn't that what Joseph said that he was going to ask? What is your occupation? And they said unto Pharaoh, thy servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers. They said moreover unto Pharaoh, for to sojourn in the land are we come, for thy servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is sore in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, we pray thee, let thy servants dwell in the land of Goshen. And Pharaoh spake unto Joseph, saying, thy father and thy brethren are come unto thee. The land of Egypt is before thee, in the best of the land make thy father and thy brethren to dwell. In the land of Goshen let them dwell. And if thou knowest any men of activity among them, make them rulers over my cattle. And so, as we see this conversation here, we can see a couple principles in this passage. There was a portion that was separated, that were selected to represent the entire group. There were 70 men that came down, and he brought five of them before Pharaoh as representation. We don't know what it was that was the criteria that Joseph used to select those five. I kind of have a feeling Simeon was probably not one of them. Probably not Reuben either. Just my guess there. I don't know. But he selected five of them, brought them, probably the best specimens in his estimation, before Pharaoh and said, this is my brother. These are the ones who's come down. And one of the principles that I see here is that in this world we have the job to be a light and a witness. We are specimens. We are to be an example of what the body of Christ is, of what Christianity is. But oftentimes it's a select few of them that actually do bear any kind of witness, any kind of representation in this world today. We looked at in Matthew whenever Jesus said, "Pray ye therefore for laborers into the harvest. For the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few." We see that there were five representatives to Pharaoh. And I'd say that's probably about on par with today. There are many people who claim the name of Christ, but very few that actually represent him. And so he is looking for people to be a representative. But then we see the other thing here is that Pharaoh said, "Look out any men of activity. If there's any men of activity amongst you, let them be rulers over my livestock, over my cattle." This goes along with what I just mentioned a minute ago. They go hand in hand. But likewise, God is looking for people, men of activity, that he can put over his work, over his service. And so anyway, going onward here, in verse 7 through 10, Jacob is brought before Pharaoh. Now imagine Jacob. He is now 130 years old. If you think back over Jacob's life, you get a little bit of an idea of what this scene would look like. You remember whenever he wrestled with the Lord at night and the Lord put his hand upon Jacob's hip and put his hip out of joint, and it says that he halted on his leg from that time forward. So as Jacob is coming into Pharaoh's chamber here, he's got his staff there and he comes in with a pretty heavy limp. He's been out under the desert sun for 130 years. He's been tending the sheep in all the different weather conditions, the hot sun and the wind and the cold and everything. He would have been a rough looking character, coming hobbling up to Pharaoh, old and crippled and weary and worn. He was not accustomed to being in such rich and wealthy places as Pharaoh's palace. Pharaoh arrayed in his very best with all of his garments of gold and all of his jewelry, and here comes a shepherd before him. And whenever Jacob comes before him, it says that he blesses Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh, being arrayed in such gorgeous garments and different things, being the king of the world according to what he thought, they worshipped him or revered him almost as a god, and this shepherd comes before him, and rather than casting himself down on his face and bowing down to Pharaoh, he rises up, stands upright, holding onto his staff, and proclaims a blessing upon Pharaoh. Now, just to give you an idea, that was out of place, because, oh, that's nice, he gave him a blessing. Pharaoh wouldn't have seen Jacob as being worthy of coming in blessing. Would you really feel all that blessed if you had some homeless person come up to you and say, "Oh, God bless you"? Just kind of trying to put it in perspective here. Whenever you're thinking of a blessing, it's someone who is greater is blessing a lesser, right? But as Jacob came up before Pharaoh, Pharaoh may have been mighty on the earth. He may have been mighty in Egypt, but Jacob was chosen of God, and he was mighty with God. And what we see here is that the greater was blessing the lesser. Maybe not in Pharaoh's estimation, but in God's it was. And what a powerful picture that would have been. But it seems as if Pharaoh had respect unto Jacob. And it's probably because he's heard much about him. And not only that, is he has sat alongside of Joseph and seen the wisdom of Joseph, and he's heard about the God of Joseph and about all of these things. And I'd say there's a little bit of intrigue with Jacob. And he sits down and he talks with Pharaoh. And in verse number 8, it says, "And Pharaoh said unto Jacob, How old art thou?" I don't know, I read a little bit of a tone into it, I guess. But he's intrigued by Jacob standing in front of him, and he says, "How old are you anyway?" He probably looked much older than what he was. He would have had the long beard. All the Egyptians would have been clean shaven. And Jacob said unto Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage," there's that word again, pilgrimage, "are 130 years. Few and evil have have the days of the years of my life been, and have not attained unto the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the day of their pilgrimage? And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. He says, I may look old, but I haven't lived as long as my fathers have. I think Abraham lived around 187, if I remember correctly. Isaac lived pretty old as well. But he says, here I am 130, and I don't think I've got too much left. Now we find out he had another 17 years after this. But he blessed Pharaoh when he came, and he blessed him when he went, which was a big change from Abraham, because Abraham had been a curse to Pharaoh, right? And so Jacob is, once again, a picture of what we should be in this world. We should be a blessing, even to the lost around us. We should be a blessing and not a curse. And so after that, we see that the remainder of the chapter is Joseph handling the kingdom during the famine. I'm not going to read over the rest of this, but he handles the kingdom during the famine. The people came and they purchased food with money until the money ran out. After about the first year, they'd run out of food. They came and they started buying food, ran out of money. And they said, okay, we have no money left. Pharaoh has all of our money and we're starving. What do we do? And Joseph says, okay, now I'll take your herds. I'll take your flocks. I'll take your cattle. And they said, well, we'll gladly give those up because we need food. Now, this is still a little bit crazy to me, because I think if they've got cattle, they've still got meat. I'm good to go. You all seen me eat. I'm going to pick meat over bread, okay? But anyway, they said, we'll give up our herds because we have nothing to feed them. I guess that's a big part of it, right? You can't eat all the cows at once, and you've got to feed them till you eat them. And they couldn't feed them. So they said, we'll sell you all of our cattle for food. And so they did that. And so now they've ran out of food once again. They don't have any money. They don't have any cattle. And then they come to Joseph and they said, you've got our money. You've got our cattle. We have no food and we're going to die. What good is our life if we die? So we're offering ourselves to you. We will give you ourselves and our land if you will feed us. And all of the people of Israel basically make themselves wards of the state. They said, we will offer ourselves freely to you to do whatever you will with us as long as you feed us. And if you notice the third part of that, they offered it willingly. Joseph didn't say, hey, I'll make a deal with you. They said, we will be your servants as long as you'll take care of us, as long as you'll feed us. And so all of Egypt willingly submitted themselves to Joseph and to Pharaoh so they could survive the famine. We find that through all of this, that Joseph says, okay, I'll take you. I'll take your land. He redistributes the people on the land to where he can care for them properly, see to it that everyone is fed, everybody has what they need. And he says, I'll give you the seed that you need to plant. You keep four parts and you give one part. 20%, okay, 20% tax to Egypt. And they said, it sounds wonderful to us because we would die otherwise. And they all celebrated because of Joseph's brilliance and his ability to keep track, or not keep track, but to take care of them. Now, us in our modern day context, we don't like that idea of belonging to the government. Sometimes we feel that way, right? And those of you here working today, you probably would be happy with 20% tax at the moment, because I know it's a lot higher than that here. But at this time, they were coming and willingly submitting. And by the way, they were submitting to a benevolent leader. That's one of the problems or one of the reasons why we're so adverse to this idea at the moment, is because we have seen so many corrupt leaders. We've seen so many wicked men who are in power. But here we see that Joseph was not one of those. As I've said time after time, Joseph is a type of Christ. And he led them in a godly manner, and they were more than happy to come and submit themselves to him. Now, whenever Joseph passed on, that kind of backfired on him a little bit, didn't it? But anyway, we can see a parallel in our Christian lives as God allows situations in our lives to bring us to the place that we are willing to depend upon him. Usually what happens in our lives, we depend on ourselves. We depend on our money, right? I can take care of me. I've still got money in the bank. If money runs out, well, I can still work. I can still do this. I still have my liquid assets. I've still got my house I can sell. I've still got this. I've got that. And what happens whenever that runs out? God works in our lives, not necessarily with possessions and money, but he works in our lives taking away one at a time the things where we think we can handle it ourselves. Our trust in ourselves, our own abilities to provide, until we're left looking to him. Because that's what he's seeking all along, is for us to trust him, and he wants to take care of us. And he does that in our lives, and he grows us in this way, and he brings circumstances into our lives, causing us to give them over to him and trust in him. That's what we call sanctification or Christian growth. Slowly that refining process. And by the way, just like the children of Israel, or excuse me, the children of Egypt here, it is willingly that he takes it. He's not forcing himself. He's not snatching things away from you. But as he proves himself, and as your situations prove beyond your ability to handle, you're more than happy to turn it over to him and trust him. And that's what he's seeking to do. Also, as with the rest of Joseph's story, our passage also gives us a great picture of God's dealings with the nation of Israel in the end times. I do want to say that we can't build our doctrine off of types or parables or pictures in the Bible, okay? But there are many times that those types and those parables and those pictures back up the doctrine that we read in other places. And we see that here with the end times, with how God deals with Israel. It helps us to understand the way that he works with them. And there are some today that think that God's done with Israel, that he replaced them whenever they rejected him back in Jesus' day. That's not the case. There's still many promises that he's got for them that's left unfulfilled, and he will fulfill those. We looked at prophecy on Sunday, and I said that all the prophecy that has been fulfilled indicates that he is going to fulfill all of the rest of it as well. That includes to the nation of Israel. And so, as we stated last week, Joseph was the beloved of the father, but he was rejected of his brothers. He was sold to the Gentiles. He was counted as dead, but while he was away, he received a Gentile bride. When famine or tribulation came, he dealt with his brothers to reconcile them to himself and cared for them through it all. And all of these, and all of the things that men trust in failed, and in the end, they all submitted themselves freely to Joseph as if he was a king. This is what God's plan is for Israel as well. They rejected him the first time. At this time, he is gathering a Gentile bride. That's you and me. During the tribulation period, be time of great war, pestilence, famine, and all of those things. And God will use that to deal with Israel, to bring them back to himself. And that during that time, they will turn back to him, and he will care for them. And basically, during the time of the tribulation, he's going to take away everything that men trust in, and then he's going to usher in his millennial kingdom. He's going to come, and he's going to rule and reign as a benevolent king. And they're willingly going to submit themselves to him at that time. We see a picture of that going on here. And so, anyway, that's just kind of a snapshot, so to speak, of how this parallels. I told you last week that it's no coincidence that the Bible spends so much time on the story of Joseph and his brothers and them coming into Egypt as they did. Because it does perfectly parallel end times events. It also gives us a lot of comparisons, a lot of pictures for our own Christian lives, for our current day events. But anyway, we've got the children of Israel and Israel himself down in Egypt. Next week, Lord willing, we're going to finish up the book of Genesis. We're going to look at Israel's prophecies for his children and his grandchildren. And he tells what's going to happen through each of these, and we'll see a little bit about that and how they're fulfilled. But with that, does anyone have any questions or comments or anything to add to what we said tonight? Okay, well, if we don't have anything, go ahead and go to the Lord in prayer. Be dismissed for tonight. Dear Lord, we come to you tonight. Thank you for your blessings, and thank you for all that you do for us. Thank you for loving us and for taking care of us, Lord. We thank you for this passage in your word, Lord, that we've looked at. And Lord, just pray, ask you, Lord, that you be with us and grow us and draw us near to you. Help us, Lord, that we would trust in you, that we would follow you, that we would seek your will, Lord, that we'd be a light and a witness in this world that we're in. And Lord, just thank you so much for all you do. And all these things I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.